So, you're from Houston?
Yes, I was born in Fort Worth and then grew up in Houston.
Yeah, it's my hometown, too.
Is it?
Huh. My family lives there. My brother and my father is still there. What part of Houston did you grow up in?
I lived near Memorial over on West Belt, what they used to call West Belt. They put this beltway through now, but it's like Westheimer and Memorial area.
My father had a house in Briar Grove. You know, are you familiar with that? It's not far from the Galleria.
Yeah, sure. I had a bunch of friends living there.
And he's 83 and he's in a nursing home now. So my brother has sold the house. We're going to have a closing on Friday. I'm going to go down there in early May. I go down maybe once a year. I like Houston a lot. It seems to be a kind of a poor excuse to locate a city, though. There's not much around it except the Houston Ship Channel. You kind of wonder about it. It doesn't have any natural grandeur the way you describe Montana, does it?
It really doesn't. It's got a, not unless the heat and swampiness is a, you know, is a, it has the same kind of force, but it's not grandeur. It's a hot place. Floods, rains hard.
Yeah. It's incredible. When I grew up there, it was during the war, during the big war, the big one. Mm-hmm. I was a kid during that war. We didn't have air conditioning. We had Yankee-style houses and with screened-in porches. And
yeah,
I swear the heat never bothered me. But I go back now, and it's suffocating.
Yeah.
I think also the coldest day of my life was spent on a Thanksgiving day there, and it wasn't, temperature may have been in the 50s, but it's so humid and so damp that I got a chill and I can still feel it. So cold. Well, tell me a little bit about yourself, because I was reading some of the material indicating that you are a petroleum geologist. That's kind of unusual to be a writer and a petroleum geologist. How did that come about?
I was doing this geology, you know, working at that job, and I started writing little articles and stories on my lunch break. I used to read a bunch. I hadn't really studied it in school. I studied writing in school. I studied wildlife science and then changed my major to geology. So I was just messing around, and gradually it got more and more important to me. I read this book by this writer, Jim Harrison, called Legends of the Fall, and after I read that book, I was still working. I stopped fooling around, and I quit my job and was going to consult, do geology as a consultant, and spend more time writing. And ever since then, it's just gradually become more and more writing versus geology ratio, so that now I do very little geology at all, almost all writing.
Where did you go to college?
Utah State University in northern Utah, a little town called Logan. In 76, it was, it's gotten pretty big. All the towns along the Wasatch Front there have gotten large, but back then it was a real small place and had a great time. It was a lot of fun.
And you moved back to Texas to ply your trade as a petroleum geologist?
Yeah, I left, went back to, actually Mississippi is where I got hired, and I didn't know there was any oil and gas in Mississippi, but but there was, and that was a fun, I guess 7-8 years looking for it, and a lot of fun. And then I got to missing the West and moved on back west.
What do you do as a petroleum geologist anyway?
I would map and look for oil and gas reservoirs. And
when you dig lines down into the earth to see if there are samples?
Yeah, pretty much. We drill wildcat wells, and then if we made a discovery, we'd drill develop the field around it. And I did both wildcat and development work, and it's a great job. It's like looking for buried treasure. It was great fun to sit up in your office and draw these maps with just pencil and paper, and yet the outcome would be millions and millions of dollars if you were right, and it could be a million or two if you were wrong, just the cost of drilling and taking the leases.
Yeah, my uncle I don't think he was a geologist. I think he was a petroleum engineer, is that
mm-hmm.
correct? He was in charge of offshore oil drilling in the North Sea and later in the Gulf of Mexico for Mobil Oil. He's retired now to a town in Texas called Tyler. But he lived all over the world and lived in London for a long time and enjoyed it. It was kind of strange for a Texan with his drawl to live in London. And it was hard for him here. He moved Mobile at one time, had their headquarters here in New York.
Yeah, that's right.
And so they shipped him back here.
Huh.
He had a beautiful home in Connecticut. We went up to visit him a couple of times. But he had this Texas-Oklahoma... Actually, he was born in Oklahoma, so he had a Texas-Oklahoma drawl that put people off up here. You know, they thought, well, this guy has a drawl, he must be a hick. Well, he's about as far from being a hick. I mean, he's lived all over the world, you know, and a resourceful, intelligent man with a drawl that you get used to, you know. And he was telling me stories about it. He would, for example, he was having a banking problem. He'd call his bank. He'd get a clerk who would try to write him off. And he had a lot of money in this bank, you know, to try to write him off as some hick calling to make a complaint, you know, because of his accent. He would usually get it squared away. Well, you've got an accent, but it's not as severe as my Uncle Bob's.
Yeah. It comes and goes. If I spend much time in Texas, it comes back. But
no, I do too.
It vanishes.
Well, I moved from Houston to Ohio. My family moved, and it didn't take long to have the drawl beaten out of me. When you're in the sixth grade and the teacher calls on you and you stand at your desk and say, "Ma'am," you know, and the other kids start laughing, you learn fairly quickly to blend in with the rest of them. Well, tell me about your... And I was reading some of your stories, some of them set in Houston, too, which I enjoyed. You said the writing became more and more important to you, writing in your lunch hours and things like that. So how did it come about? Did you actually get a published story somewhere?
I did. I wrote dozens and dozens of stories before I had any published, and I sent them dozens and dozens of places. I had like over 1,000 rejections before I sold my first short story, my first fiction.
1,000 rejections?
Oh, yeah, over. You know, and that's not that many, because if you've got like 30 stories and you send them 30 places, that's 900 right there. And I had, I bet I had 50 stories. You know, that they just weren't any of them any good. But then I read that Legends of the Fall book, and I quit my job and wrote this kind of long story. Actually, it was about an oil and gas geologist, and I sent it off to Paris Review, and they said they liked it and wanted to publish it, and that was that. After I wrote that story, I learned how to write stories better, I think, and used that one kind of as a model, that Legends of the Fall story, to learn what the difference was between maybe a good story and a great one. And, you know, I realized that there was a step up, that, you know, there was some really, really great writing out there, and I wanted mine to be some of it, and so I tried harder. But
can one make a living writing stories?
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, you can't go around buying a bunch of stuff, but you can live, yeah.
Well, at some point, you were in Mississippi. At some point, you just mentioned a moment ago, you decided to go west. What brought that about?
Well, I'd gone to school at Utah State, and I'd loved the country out there. I loved being up in the mountains, and I'd always kind of wanted to get back. And there wasn't a lot of oil and gas work going on out there. And I was getting settled into Mississippi, you know, my job there. And so it was kind of a now or never decision. I guess I was 27, and it could, you know, I could blink and be 37 and then 47. I just needed to do it, you know, while I was still young. And so my girlfriend and I got in the truck and drove looking for a place to move to out there. And we found it.
Now we start the story that we find in your new book called Winter. You go out west, and you weren't sure exactly what you were looking for or where you were going, were you?
No, I just wanted to drive till I saw the mountains and then start picking our way through the canyons and valleys and find, you know, well, we didn't even really know anything specific. We just knew that we wanted to have mountains around us.
Did you want isolation?
Yeah, we knew that. and a lot of space and a lot of quietness.
You found some near misses, though, didn't you?
We stopped. We thought we'd find the place in New Mexico out in the grasslands area, and it's nice country, but there weren't any homes out there, and we didn't have any money. We couldn't have built one. We had just about a year's worth, not really years, probably 6 or 8 months worth of savings that were taken with us, and so we were on a pretty tight budget. And what we wanted to do was find a place to rent, or even a place we could live for free, and didn't find it in New Mexico. And so we turned north and went up into Utah and Colorado. And oh, there was a place in Colorado that might have worked out, but it was a real high elevation. It was like 11 or 12,000 feet, and you know, you just couldn't get there in the winter. And it had been too severe, so we kept going north. We wanted, you know, a place that we could live year-round. And we went all the way up to Washington State, and it turned around, and we're heading back home feeling kind of disappointed. We thought, well, we'll just live in a city, a little city like Whitefish, Montana, is where we decided to look around and rent a house for the winter. And then this was in summer when we were exploring.
Was this arbitrary that you selected Whitefish?
I knew that I liked that country. I had been up there once before, and it seemed like a nice small town. And so we stopped off there in Whitefish and went in the realtor's office and, you know, made our usual explanation that we wanted a place where I could have a lot of privacy and write. And Elizabeth paints, and so she wanted, a studio, and we wanted all kinds of stuff. And, you know, we wanted to live there real cheaply. And this guy happened to have this one place that fit that bill. The owner only came out once a year to hunt. It was a big hunting lodge is what the place was. And he says, well, it's for sale. Why don't you go look at it? And we didn't, it was like $250,000, $500,000. I don't know what he was selling it for. And we went out there and looked at it. And the caretakers that were living there at that time had decided that morning that they were going to have to move. They couldn't make a living there. They couldn't make another winter there. So they said, well, you know, they said to Elizabeth and me, if y'all weren't interested in buying it, would you want to caretake it? And so everything fell into place.
Now, exactly where is this lodge?
Oh, it's in northwestern Montana. It's on the Canadian line and the Idaho line. It's not really near any town. It's north of a little town called Libby and east of a little town, even smaller town called Troy. But it's not any. It's just this. It's a valley. The valley is called Yak, but it's just back in the woods.
Now, are you up high or down low?
It's in mountains. The elevation is not terribly high. It's about 3,000 feet. That's the low end of Montana, the lowest spot in the state. It's right on a big river, a gorge that cuts the elevation down in that part of the state. But it's a real mountainous valley.
So as you write, in the winter you decided to move in. I think Elizabeth came at a slightly later date, mm-hmm. with her stuff, and you had the dogs.
Right.
And so you moved in. Tell me about the lodge. Tell me about the accommodations. What was it like? You're still there, aren't you?
Yes.
Now, what's it like?
It's real big. It's I don't know how many, feet or whatever the measurements are, but it's too big to keep warm. It's very cold in the winter. The water supply comes from a pond up on the hill. The National Forest is behind the house. There's like a couple million acres that we can just walk out into. It's real fairy tale like. It's got hardwood floors, log floors, log walls. Got indoor plumbing. There's no electricity. And there's no phone, of course. For a while we used a little shortwave radio, but we got rid of that. It broke, and we just never fixed it. We got so used to not having it. And the radio was kind of a hassle to operate. It ran off a 12-volt battery, and it would draw the battery down, and you had to charge it back up. And if the wind was blowing or something, your reception or transmission was real poor. Reception was okay. But
there was a generator.
That's right. There's a propane generator, and we run that two and a half, 3 hours a night. And I'll do my typing on the electric word processor. But we can't run the generator too long, or it'll get hot and break. It's tough to start.
Your work space is in a greenhouse.
That's where I do my writing. Just write longhand.
Isn't that cold?
It's very cold. There's a little stove in there, but boy, it doesn't. Yeah, You have to touch it to get hot. It's real, real cold.
So you write mostly by hand?
Yeah, entirely by hand, and then transcribe it to the word processor.
What kind of word processor do you use?
It's a Panasonic. I don't know what the number is, but it's just.
But you can only use it a couple of hours a day.
Yeah, in the evening, is usually what I do, and I write faster than I type, so I get farther and farther behind with my transcription of thousands of pages written that I have not yet gotten typed. So that's the only drawback to not having electricity, 24 hours a day. But it's worth it. It's worth it.
Isn't that an awkward arrangement, the not being able to type directly to the word processor?
Not for me, because I've always written out longhand anyway, so I wouldn't, even if I had electricity, I don't know that it's awkward. It's not as efficient, but it's the way I like to work. I like to write, and that's just part of it, so I don't even question it.
Winter is written in kind of a form of a diary, and one thing that I noticed as you began to establish yourself in your new home, you began to anticipate the coming of, winter. Tell me about that, because you knew the winter was going to be a severe one.
Yeah, we, coming from Mississippi, when I lived in Utah, I was in a dorm, so I didn't really experience any deep winter. I had some cold spells, and I'd go camping a lot, but, just for a few days at a time. I'd never lived out in the woods in hard winter, and we went up there from Mississippi. I moved up the last couple of days of August, and Elizabeth came out mid-September, so we had about a month to get ready to learn what we were going to learn and start laying our wood supply in. We didn't have any. That's all there is to heat the place up there is one fireplace and one little stove in the kitchen. And it's like three floors and all these guest rooms and stuff and big rooms. So we closed off the ones we weren't going to use, but still the rooms we used, we knew we had to get a lot of wood and had to learn, what kind of machines to get, what kind of truck to buy. And
how do you learn things like that?
We'd talk to people. We'd ask them questions. There's a bar there in the valley, and we'd go in there and sit around and drink some beers. And the people that had time to tell us stuff, they'd tell us. Most everybody was kind of in a hurry to get their own wood, too. So there was a nice air of, I won't even call it anticipation. It was stronger than that. It was it was pretty frantic, but that was fun. It was fun trying to learn what we needed to know, and we continued learning all through the winter, about how to run the saw and how to keep it running and how to fix the generator when it went down and what kind of snow chains to use on the tires and how to run the winches and how to keep the water from freezing and when it froze in the pipes, how to re-weld them and just all the usual traumas of hard, cold weather.
You got to know just about everybody in the valley, huh? Not very many in the winter anyway, right?
Yeah, no, there weren't. There's even fewer people up there in the winter than there are a year in the summer. So it was not too hard to get to meet everyone. There's maybe a couple dozen people.
So what was it like, your first major freeze or snow?
I liked it, which was a surprise. I thought I was going to be real frightened of it, and not enjoy it, but I just love it. I love it. Maybe it's being in Houston so long and in Mississippi too, and that terrible heat. I've been cold before, but never up there. I love the cold up there. I mean, and in Alaska, the same thing. 40 below it feels good. If it's windy and wet, that's what I don't like. Like the coldest I've ever been was in Mississippi at about 25 degrees, and it was kind of raining and sleeting and blowing, 20 mile an hour wind, and I was living in an old farmhouse with no heat. But up there, it's all the cliches that you hear. It's a dry cold, and you dress for it, and you stay active, you ski or snowshoe or something. So it was not anticlimactic, but it was a very strong cold, but it felt very good. I loved it, and that's kind of part of the book, is how much I did enjoy that first winter.
Yes, in fact, you write that you kept being disappointed that the winter kept putting itself off to a certain degree.
Yeah,
waiting for that first big snowfall to arrive, and I think it was late the first winter you were there.
It was a drought year, that's right. It was felt like we disrupted some kind of party or something, like, it just wasn't going to come, it wasn't going to show up. But boy, when it did, it was so pretty. It was
Now, after the snow came, isn't there a feeling of being trapped or isolated?
Yeah, well, it's there is a feeling of being isolated, but it's like the rest of the world is cut off from you, not like you're cut off from it. It's a lovely feeling. You know, you can always get out and ski out if you have to, but nobody knows. Nobody wants to mess around in that deep snow, and they don't want to get out in their cars and then ski in. It's a very very good feeling. You go out and you don't ever see anybody or anything. I mean, you see a lot of wildlife in the winter, but you don't ever see any people.
What keeps you busy during the course of the day?
Just a real nice, lazy, luxurious schedule. I just I'll go out in the morning out to the greenhouse and write for 2, maybe 2.5, 3 hours, and then come on back in and do some paperwork, and then eat lunch, and then I'll go hiking or skiing or something. For pretty much the rest of the afternoon, then come back in the evening, eat supper, and after it's dark and I've read, you know, I may read a little bit or do some more letter writing or something, then crank up the generator and type for a couple hours, and then that's kind of the end of the day. I'll shut the generator off and read and wake up and do it again in the morning.
How about Elizabeth? How does she feel about all this?
She loves it up there too. It's she really likes the isolation and the time, the pace. It's real nice and slow.
Now, there is a certain degree of social life that you write about in winter. Tell me about that.
The women up there play pinochle. They've got a pinochle club, and they kind of a support group to when everything gets real still in the center, in the middle of the winter, and there's people up there that like to, you know, to see each other's company. So they'll play once a week, and they have potluck suppers, just every now and then, pretty regular, not any certain schedule, but there's always one. You know, if it's not coming soon, there will be one scheduled. People up there ski a lot, love to cross-country ski, and that's the best, I don't know if the word is antidote, but that's the best medicine for winter, is just get, you know, put your skis on and ski some new place where you haven't been before, because you just go and go until you're so tired you can barely turn around and get back, and just wear yourself out, and it's such a fun thing to do.
Now, you have, there are a number of colorful people in that valley, but there's one in particular, the rather taciturn, rather cranky neighbor that you have. Tell me about him. By the way, did you use real names in the book?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, Breitenstein, he knows everything about the valley. His family has been there longer than any other family since 1903, and he's not that old. He's probably in his 50s, but he lives a hard life, and he still does all his sawing, and he'll break his arm or leg and just keep on going. He's a tough guy, but he knows everything, and he's a perfectionist, and so it drove him nutty to, you know, when we wandered up there and our truck broke, so we were having to haul our firewood in the back seat of this little Ford Falcon we had, and this drove him berserk, you know. And then I was cutting with the chainsaw all wrong, so he'd show me how to do that, and he had advice on every little thing, which was good. That's what we needed. But it was fun seeing how upset he would get by our actions.
I was interviewing Gary Snyder, the poet. I don't know if you've familiar with his work.
Yeah.
But he lives in similar surroundings. He also has a generator. And he lives in California in a very isolated area. I gave him a copy of your book,
because
he would enjoy that. And I mentioned the problems we were having with the chainsaw, and he took to that because he knows all about chainsaws. He's had all sorts of problems with his chainsaws and everything. So I knew he was going to enjoy that section of the book. Well, what happens in the summer? Now you're away. I mean, we're in the spring now, approaching summer. The wind is still probably pretty cold up there, though, isn't it?
It's not so bad. It's about like it is here. It's, you know, gets down to 15, 20 at night, and then 35, 40. Sometimes up in the 50s in the daytime, and you'll have hot spells come through, and it'll jump up to 65, then it'll cold spell come through and go back down to zero. It's a real erratic time of year, but the magnitude of the bleeps is ironing out somewhat. It's starting to calm down.
Now, this is what, your third year there?
Fourth, yeah.
Your fourth year. What happens in the summer? You're still the caretaker.
Oh, yeah.
You have
guests
coming up, huh?
No. The guy that owns it just comes out once a year and deer hunts during, you know, in the fall during deer season. But the only guests sometimes we'll have our family or friends come out, and that's all. It's just more the same. You just you can make better time on your hikes in the summer because there's no snow down. So, but it's the same old schedule. Just ride in the morning and go hiking in the afternoon. And
so the deal is he lets you stay there in turn for maintaining the property.
Right.
He doesn't. You're not a paid employee though.
No.
How do you now in the winter? How do you get your stuff out? Your stories and essays.
Oh, mail keeps coming. She.
You don't have a mailman delivering it.
Yeah, she's very valiant. She comes 5 days a week. She drives, you know, 40 miles to get there and 40 miles back. And
just for you? Well, not.
No, there's some other people who live up there, and it's you know, she's our link. So she's our buddy all year round, but especially in winter, you know, because that's a big deal when the mail comes. It's a big event of the day. In fact, we wait for the mail and then we go hiking.
No, of course, it's a big event to go to the city, too. I think you mentioned that you would, didn't you try to sign up for a health club and so forth?
Yeah, yeah. And
there's all that cross-country skiing. I wonder if you need a health club.
We call it town day if we have to go to town that day. So it's just something that has to be done. Like we'll have to go do, may have to express mail something or make photocopies or... you know, shop for groceries. So it's a long haul. In the winter, it's about an hour and a half to town one way. And then it's a tough road, too, a real dangerous road. It's on a cliff, just like some old movie or something. It's a real, real dangerous road.
Aren't you afraid of becoming ill?
Oh, no. I mean, if you get ill, you're going to get ill. I mean, no, we like living where we live. I mean, that would be. It just seems so silly to stay in a city if you wanted to be out in the country and wait around to get sick so that it will have been worthwhile. You know, I know what you're saying, but it's not something.
Well, let me rephrase the question.
Well, I don't mean to make it sound silly, but
what happens if you're sawing wood and all of a sudden the saw slips and goes into your groin?
Well,
what are you going to do then?
Well, you know, yell and bleed. I guess that's. That's, well, you know, you take a certain caution. It's in the back of your mind when you're in dangerous situations. The most danger I ever get in, well, the saw is dangerous, but if I get tired, I stop using it, so I don't put myself in that situation. But really the times I find myself thinking about it are when I'm out hiking or hunting or something. It'll be, you know, near dark, and I'll be thrashing around and windfall and timber and snow and you know, or ice, and your leg punches through holes and stuff, or you fall forward between two logs, and you're always hurting yourself, but you don't want to break a leg, and you know, especially on top of a mountain, and the mountains are so steep up there. The north slopes are incredibly steep and incredibly laced with fallen timber, so it's very easy to get lost up there, and if it gets cold, you know, you can get hypothermia. That's the danger there. So you move kind of slow, or I do, because you don't want to slip on rocks and stuff.
How long are you going to be doing this, Rick?
Indefinitely, as long as I can, until maybe people move into the valley and it gets crowded.
So you're planning to maintain your future in this valley?
Yeah, yeah.
Never going to go back to Houston?
Well, I go back all the time and visit my family, but no, I would never live in Houston or any other city for more than, say, a month at a time.
Mm-hmm.
If I had work to do or something. I spent a month down there this fall, November, researching some stuff. And, you know, it's okay because I know I can go back to Yak.
Well, obviously, winter, you've got mileage out of living in that valley and with regard to your book, Winter. But what about your other work? Is that providing you with a certain degree of inspiration?
Or? Oh, a lot. You know, I write best when I'm at peace or when I'm happy, and I'm very happy up in that area. So, I've got too much to write about, way too much. It's a problem, if anything. Too much time and too many ideas.
Now, are these ideas springing from your experience in the valley or from earlier experiences?
About half and half. You've got more time to remember things and more time to imagine things and more time to observe things. So it's a good deal for a writer.
Are you focusing primarily on fiction?
No, about half and half. I write a lot of both. Excuse me.
Because, winter, of course, I have your book of short stories in winter, but this is, winter is actually your fifth book, isn't it?
Yes, uh-huh.
Well, it's a good experience for you, and this is a beautifully, beautifully written book, and it also should be pointed out that Elizabeth, what is her last name?
Bass. We got married 3 weeks ago.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Well, the artwork, which is rather unusual in a book today, is done by Elizabeth Bass. So all in all, it's a beautifully done book.
Thanks. It is.
Rick, it was very nice talking to you. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.